Welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith Larman. In this episode, I talk with Peter Benjaminson about his book, Mary Wells, The Tumultuous Life of Motown's First Superstar, published in 2012 by the Chicago Review Press. In the book, Benjaminson reminds us of the significance of Mary Wells, not just for Motown records and the Motown sound, but for the shape of popular music in the second half of the 20th century. Her usually breathy, sometimes gruff voice is still heard regularly on any number of media types around the world. A few of her songs, My Guy especially, but also You Beat Me to the Punch, Bye Bye Baby, and Two Lovers, are bedrocks of a pop rock sound originating with Motown in the 60s and are still with us today. Benjaminson's book is a biography, and as such he covers many facets of Wells' life. Her music career, of course, is of primary importance. He follows Wells from her early career at Motown, where she recorded her most lasting songs, to 20th Century Fox, ATCO, Jubilee, EMI, Reprise, Epic, and many others, including her last record of original music, 1990's Keeping My Mind on Love on Motor City Records. Benjaminson also writes of Wells' professional and personal relationships, the lines of which were often blurred. Herman Griffin, Smokey Robinson, Berry Gordy, David Ruffin, the men of Holland Dozier Holland, and brothers Cecil and Curtis Womack, each of whom she was married to at one point or another. In the end, Wells always considered herself to be a star, the woman who put Motown on the map. However, she lived a life of frustration at the lack of respect and, especially, revenue she received from her stardom. A consequence of this frustration, writes Benjaminson, was a life filled with drug use, abusive relationships, and constant hard touring. To top it off, Mary Wells was passed up twice by the electors of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Peter Benjaminson lives in New York City, which is where I reached him for this interview. Hello, Peter, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for being here. So before we get specifically to your to Mary Wells' book, Peter, can you tell us a little bit about your biography, please? Where are you from? Those kind of things.
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., and I worked for the Detroit Free Press from 1970 to 76. Then later on, I worked for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Then I worked in various teaching jobs. I was a professor of journalism and basically became a full-time writer, which I was doing all my life, but I became a full-time writer fairly recently, the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Now and I live in Harlem in New York City.
Fabulous. And I see the biography that you've written a few other books on Motown. How did you become interested in Motown? You lived in Detroit, obviously, but...
Yes, well, that's how. I was living in Detroit. I lived there for 7 years as a reporter for the Free Press. And this was a long time ago, but your listeners probably remember when Woodward and Bernstein kicked Richard Nixon out of office using a new device that they called investigative reporting. I was a reporter then, and with another reporter named Dave Anderson, we decided to find out what investigative reporting was all about. So we went to the library. This was long before any computers existed, except in research facilities in the desert. Anyway, we went to the library and tried to find a book on investigative reporting. We realized after a little while that there never had been any book written on investigative reporting. So we looked at each other, light bulbs went on over our heads, and we decided, hey, we do that kind of stuff. We ought to write one. So we wrote the first how-to book ever on investigative reporting called Investigative Reporting.
It was a very creative
title. Yeah, that word springs to mind. It was a big seller. It was in print for 20 years, two different publishers, several editions. And I really liked the whole process. So I thought, what else is there in Detroit to write about? There was obviously the auto industry, but that had already been written about by people much more qualified than I was. So I looked around and basically saw the Motown Record Company and figured I could write about that. At that time, when I was looking at it in 1976, no one had ever written a book in this country on the Motown Record Company, although it was already moving past its heyday and into its old age. And many millions of people were familiar with it, but there was no book on the subject, so I decided to write one.
And which one was the first one? Was it Florence Ballard or the story of Motown?
Well, it was the two were mixed up, because what happened was I was sitting in the city room of the Detroit Free Press, which is a bad place for a reporter to be. I was there basically because I didn't have an idea for a story to do that day. So the editor came over and said, listen, Peter, we've just got a rumor that Florence Ballard of the Supremes is on welfare. Now, this was the equivalent at the time of me walking down the street now and hearing a rumor that Joe Biden was has been on food stamps for the last few years. I knew it was a big story. So I went out to see Flo Ballard. She lived in Detroit. I mean, I lived there too, so it wasn't a big trip. And interviewed her about the fact that she indeed had gone on welfare. I did a story about her, and it got a lot of sympathy for her. People's reaction was, we thought you were living it up in Florida or somewhere. Why didn't you tell us? We would have helped you, et cetera, et cetera. So she invited me back to her house on weekends and after work to tape her vocal or oral, I should say, autobiography, which I did. Then I started trying to sell that book, and very unfortunately, but fortunately for the book, I guess, she died in 1976, which was 1 year after I taped her autobiography or her autobiographical memoirs. And so I tried to sell the book. I flew to New York, tried to sell the book to Grove Press, and they pointed out that just like with investigative reporting, no book had ever been written on the Motown Record Company. So another light bulb went on over my head, and I said, okay, I'll do that. And I wrote the book, The Story of Motown, which is, as I said, the first book ever written in this country on the story of, on the Motown Record Company.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a pause of exactly 32 years between my first book on Motown and the second book on Motown, which was The Lost Supreme, The Life of a Dream Girl, Florence Ballard. I wrote several other books on other subjects. You know, my hair got gray. I got married, divorced, and remarried. I had a child. I went into different fields. 32 years passed by until I was finally able to sell my original idea, which was the book on Flo Ballard. I think it was because the movie Dreamgirls came out and made money and convinced the powers that be this sort of subject would also make money. And in fact, the book was very successful. And that led to the book that we may be talking about in a couple of minutes, and that's the Mary Wells book, which is the third book on Motown. Very nicely, the Wall Street Journal has dubbed me the Motown historian for these three books, which is, I'm unworthy of it, but still, it's been a lot of fun writing about Motown over these last, I guess, 37 years.
So not to belabor the point of your earlier books, though, but so the Flo Ballard book, you published it 32 years after you wrote it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, 32 years after Flo gave me her insights into her own life.
Okay.
It was actually a good thing because a lot of other stuff came out that she hadn't told me about in that intervening 32 years, which I was, and I also did a lot of research on it over the years. So I was able to put all the new material in the book, plus her what she told me on the tape recording in 1975.
Right. So in 75, you got the interviews, and then in the 2000s, you actually wrote the book.
That's correct.
I get it. Okay. Let's get to the book we're here to talk about, though.
Right.
Why do you choose Mary Wells?
Well, the Lost Supreme book came out, and as I said, it was very successful. Then I was sitting in my apartment one day, and a guy called me from Florida named Randy Russey. I'd never met him. He was just calling me out of the blue. He said he had been a friend of Mary Wells in Florida, and indeed Mary did live in Florida, had lived in Florida, and he was one of her friends. And he said, look, I love The Lost Supreme, but the Mary Wells story is even more interesting than Flo Ballard's story. And I actually got kind of mad at him. I said, look, Randy, you know, it took me 32 years to get that book into print, and there were certainly years of work on it. Why should I write the same story? You know, you just want me to write the same story and change the names? I mean, once again, an African-American girl from the Detroit ghetto goes to Motown, is a big success, and then her career drops off later. It would just be a repeat of the book. So he very patiently told me the 100 or so differences between Mary Wells' story and Flo Ballard's story, and convinced me to write the book. Then The Lost Supreme had been so successful that the same publisher agreed almost immediately to write the Mary Wells book, and it's been doing very well, so to speak. I don't mean to make a pun on the word well, but it's almost impossible not to. It's been reviewed in like USA Today, Wall Street Journal. It's been on TV, so I'm riding high on it, and I'm really glad, not only for me, but because I think Mary Wells deserves not to be forgotten and had a very rough life trying to maintain her starhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into the book then. Let's roughly go along the chapters that you do. So early on, tell us chapter one. Tell us a bit about Mary's childhood and even mix in what was Detroit like at the time.
Well, those are two different stories, really. Detroit at the time was very musical. It was also quite prosperous and quite crowded. Anybody who wanted to really could get a default job on one of the auto assembly lines. But a lot of people didn't want to, they kept trying to make music on street corners and in the various nightclubs that sprung up around the city to, take advantage or to provide music for all the people who were earning regular paychecks on the assembly lines. So it was a very musical city, and actually a very nice one to live in. It's half in ruins now, but in 1950 it was voted the most beautiful city in America by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which certainly tells you something about the place. Mary, though, had a really rough life. Her mother was a house cleaner, and her father was, although an auto worker, was mostly absent. And when he did come home, he'd beat up on her mother. So I think it traumatized her for life, really. And then she had spinal meningitis when she was about 5 and had to spend 2 years flat on her back in the hospital. Then she had to learn to walk again after she got out of the hospital because she had, spent so long not walking. Then she got an attack of tuberculosis, which reoccurred when she was in her 20s. And things were really rough on her, but amazingly, she became a very determined person. First, for a while, she was determined to be a scientist or a doctor because she was associating with so many of them. But finally, she decided to be a musician, and that's when her life of determination, which is what I call it. I mean, she was a very determined person. That's when her determination first started to come out. So it was definitely a rough you.
Uh-huh. And does she have a musical background?
She sang in the chorus at school. And incidentally, the Detroit schools at the time had a major program of music education, which I don't think they do anymore. And she also sang in the choir at church. But this was a common experience for most kids in Detroit at the time. She had no particular experience and, as far as anyone could see, not a great talent. But she was only about 15 or 16 at the time when she decided to become a popular singer. What really did it was, there's a great quote in the book, if I do say so myself. She says first she wanted to get into the various male groups that were popular in Detroit. Some of those groups, the Temptations and others, But they didn't want her in there because it would disrupt group solidarity. She was an attractive teenage girl, so you can imagine what they meant. But she finally decided that, okay, if I can't do that, I'll be a songwriter. She decided she'd write a song for Jackie Wilson, who was a popular singer at the time. And in the quote, she says, "I went into my closet, my secret closet, and asked God to send me a song that I could write up and give to Jackie Wilson." And the song that he gave her was called Bye Bye Baby. It was a good song, an old-style black female song, and she managed to maneuver her way into performing it for Berry Gordy, who she thought was a songwriter for Jackie Wilson at the time, but actually had stopped writing for Jackie Wilson and was looking for any competent female solo singer who could become a female solo superstar at Motown. And he found her in Mary Wells. She sang the song really well. She had the dynamism to locate him and perform it. When he didn't want to hear it, she just insisted to hear it. And she went on to have a great career of about 5 years at Motown.
So tell us about Motown up to this point where she meets Berry Gordy. Were they successful at this point?
They had had a couple of hits, but they were still struggling. Gordy never, you know, the problem with most businesses everywhere, probably, and certainly in the U.S., is that they don't have enough capital to keep going. So, you know, if something goes bad, they spend some money and then they run out of money and they have to close. And that's what Gordy was worried about with Motown. Gordy had started another business prior to this. It was a jazz record store, and he lost all his capital because it closed and went bankrupt. Not enough people were interested in buying jazz records. So he was very worried that because Motown did not have a female solo singer who could become a female solo superstar, that the company would have to close down, because obviously there's a big audience for female solo singers. And so Mary really filled the gap. He saw immediately that she could be the singer he needed. So as soon as she sang the song, he told her to come down to the studio to the office the next morning with her mother. She needed her mother because she was under 18, and therefore she couldn't sign a contract without her mother's approval. He signed her up to a contract, and pretty much immediately they went right into the studio and recorded the song Bye Bye Baby, which rose to number 41 on the pop charts, which is very good for extremely good for a first-time singer. And that's where her career started.
So there's a pretty good story from Chapter 2 about her actually singing the song for the first time for Berry, isn't there? Wasn't it in a bar or somewhere?
Yeah, he was at the 20 Grand, which was a big nightclub in Detroit, and he was running back and forth between two sections of the nightclub where two of his groups were performing, you know, in different sections of the nightclub, and she latched onto him almost step by step, asking him for an appointment to allow her to come down to his office and sing the song. He kept saying, no, no, I'm too busy, get away, get away. And finally, since she refused to literally not dog his footsteps, he just turned around and said, okay, sing it right here. And she, in fact, just stood there and sang it. No accompaniment, of course, no preparation, really. She just belted it out. And he was very impressed and, as I said, hired her. Now, it's interesting, the song, they went into the studio and recorded the song, they had to do 22 takes in a row to get it right. Now, that means she, the backup singers and the backup musicians, the engineers, and Gordy, who produced it himself, had to stand there while she did 22 takes in a row, with presumably breaks in between. Her throat probably sounded much worse than my throat now. She got very hoarse by the 22nd take. And although she redid the song later, you can still buy the original recording and hear it in lots of places. And it sounds like she's been singing for hours, which in fact she had. In fact, she added to the end of the song two banshee-like wails, which I don't think were scripted into the song. She was just very, very frustrated that it had taken 22 takes to do a relatively simple song. Now, the reason it took that many takes was partly because they all were inexperienced, including obviously her. I mean, it was the first recording, but also because they had a one or two track system. That means that if anyone, like the musicians, made a mistake, then everyone else's part was ruined. They had to go back and start over. The backup singers made a mistake, then everyone had to go back and start over. Mary made a mistake, everyone had to go back and start over. It was in the early days of the recording industry. This was around 1960. So it took a while, but it came out. It was a very good song and started her career at Motown.
And so does she immediately start performing live based on this song? And what was her audience like at this point?
Yeah, she did. Maybe not after this particular song, but after she did her next song, which moved a little higher on the chart, she immediately went out on the Motown tours. They were the Motortown reviews. What the Motown did, which was unique at the time, was put all the members of the touring musicians on the same bus. That's because none of the musicians were all that popular, and they also were able to avoid a lot of racism at the time by making such a large touring group so profitable that a lot of semi-racist tour managers couldn't see their way around. I mean, they wanted to accept it because they'd make money on it. So these tours would go on for 30 days. Lots of times they couldn't find a hotel, so the people would, musicians and performers and the handlers would have to sleep on the bus, which didn't make any of them, which made a lot of them cranky, I should say. So, I mean, it couldn't bathe that often. It was really, really a horrible thing, but they managed to go all over the country, certainly the eastern half of the country, and let everyone know how good Motown singers were. So yeah, she was on those tours. Very soon, though, when she became a big star, she'd go on her own individual tours, which was, as you can imagine, much easier. She had a car and didn't have to be surrounded by all these other people, but she still had to go to a lot of venues in a short period of time. Otherwise, the tours wouldn't have been profitable.
Mm-hmm. And now Mary was considered a solo artist, but it sounds like very close on the heels of her solo success, we start getting the rise of these what we call girl groups, right? The Supremes and whoever else. How did this influence Mary's career, the rise of girl groups?
Well, it really altered it. Her first song, Bye Bye Baby, and to a certain extent her next two or three songs were traditional black female songs. They were kind of heavy, and Bye Bye Baby was a song that said, you know, how sorry I am. It was a woman saying to a guy that had left her, I'm really sorry that you left me, you really hurt me, but don't try to come back because I'll never take you back again. So this whole song was sort of an old style downer of a song. Blues, really, is what it comes down to. But as soon as the girl groups started singing, they weren't Motown groups. These were, Phil Spector was the best one, but lots of producers in Tin Pan Alley, which is basically the conglomeration of white music companies in New York, hit it big with these girl groups. The girls, the singers, the women were both white and black, or some of the girl groups were all white, some were all black. That wasn't the point. The point was that they sang very sort of teenage effervescent lyrics on top of heavy instrumental basses. Phil Spector's The Wall of Sound was the paradigm of this. You know, they sang things like Leader of the Pack and, You Drove Across the Railroad Tracks on That Fatal Night and stuff. They weren't songs that were supposed to be taken seriously, and they were like high-pitched girlish songs. And so Gordy and his songwriters and Mary immediately changed their style. They could see what the hits were now going to be like. And she started singing much lighter songs than Bye Bye Baby. You Beat Me to the Punch, Two Lovers, and My Guy was the ultimate sort of girl group song about how faithful she was going to be, or she was to her guy. So Motown was very mobile. They were willing to go anywhere and do anything to make money, which was Gordy's main thought in life. And they did very well by imitating and then taking over the girl group sounds. I mean, the Supremes were the ultimate girl group, really, until many years later. All the girl groups practically disappeared once Motown took over the girl group mantle. And even Mary, although she wasn't a group, continued to sing girl group type songs. There's a guy who wrote a book about the girl groups at the time who included Mary in his listing of girl groups, which surprised me. You know, I was doing the research. I thought, but Mary isn't a group. And he just ignored that fact because she sounded so much like the other, like the girl groups, that he sort of put her in the book anyway, even though she was a solo superstar rather than a girl group or a group at all.
Well, I imagine she had, you know, the ingredients of a girl group, you know, backup singers, musically, rhythmically, et cetera, right?
Oh, yeah.
Lyrically.
Yeah, absolutely. Although the backup singers weren't as prominent as they were in the girl groups. I mean, the girl groups may have had backup singers, but basically all the major singers were up front. You know, they were doing a choral kind of thing. But yes, Mary did indeed sound like them, and she did have backup singers. So perhaps it's only a technicality, but all the others were advertisers, the Shirelles or the Cookies and Cream or whatever, and Mary was advertised as Mary Wells. So there is a slight difference there. However, I think it showed how resourceful and flexible Motown was. I mean, certainly hit the top with Mary doing the girl group sound. I mean, My Guy was a number one hit all over the country, and in fact, in a way, it pushed the Beatles and Louis Armstrong off the top of the pop chart. And it was a very white song, in a sense. Curtis Womack, who later became Mary's third husband, he didn't even know her at the time, but he was very worried when he heard My Guy on the radio, because it sounded to him like a Patti Page song, or there were other white songs of that era, like How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? It was so unthreatening and so un-blues-like that he didn't think it would go with black people, but both black people and white people bought it, which was exactly what Motown had hoped for. So it was a big success.
Right, and this all fits in with, and you're not the first person to have made this comment, but you know, Motown and Berry Gordy, they had, I think you write, ingredients for a hit record. They, you know, had an instruction sheet almost. That this is what you need.
Yes, but the sheet changed. I mean, you had to get the latest memo, to use the modern phrase. I mean, and it changed depending on which songwriter was writing the song. I mean, they had a kind of revolving gear system of songwriters and singers. You know, the songwriters and producers were on one gear, and the singers were on another gear, and the two revolved together. So in Mary's case, she started out with Mickey Stevenson as her producer. He did a couple of hits for her they were fine, but then the next song would drop down the charts. So the gears would shift, and shift Mary to Holland Dozier Holland, who did a couple of songs with her, and then those songs would drop off. So finally, I'm simplifying it a bit, but finally they shifted her to Smokey Robinson, and he turned out to be the best songwriter she ever had at Motown or anywhere else. He did her biggest hits with her, and they were a very successful team. They had a mind meld that made Mary's songs very popular. So they were very popular, and that's one of the reasons Mary should not have left Motown. That was the big mistake in her life, and even she admitted it years later, that leaving Motown at the height of her success was a big mistake.
Much of your book centers around different professional / personal relationships that Mary had with people. So let's step back just a moment. An important person in her professional and personal life was Herman Griffin. Tell us about that relationship.
Well, Herman was her first band leader at Motown. He'd lead the band. I would have loved to have seen his performance, because people described him as really astonishing. As Mary would finish up her early hits with by singing one big note, for instance, Herman would do acrobatics behind her. He'd do backflips, double forward flips, and basically it distract the audience from I would think it would distract the audience from Mary singing. But sorry.
Okay.
But people who saw and said it actually worked out. They coordinated it well. His backflips and double flips would sort of emphasize what she was doing. So they were a great pair, at least on stage. Then she made the mistake of marrying him. Incidentally, you know, she wanted to. One of the things she was determined about in life, and she was a very determined person, one of the things she was determined about was to try to make her family much better than her parents were as a family. So she went over to see Herman Griffin's father. When she was thinking about marrying Herman, she went over to see his father, who lived in a house in Detroit, and basically interviewed him about how he was as a family man, et cetera, et cetera. Then I guess she was satisfied with the interviews because she got married to Herman, which unfortunately turned out to be a mistake. Herman cheated on her with a prostitute, and she wasn't going to take that, so she divorced him. But nevertheless, she kept him on as business manager, mistakenly thinking that he had her career. You know, advancing her career in mind. But I think what he really wanted was to get her away from Motown so he could collect some percentage of her, of what he thought would be her big royalties and big income after she left Motown. So her whole association with Herman Griffin was a mistake. But she had many other relationships in her life for both personal and business reasons.
Mm-hmm. So Herman, even after they divorced, he was her manager for quite a while, wasn't he?
Yes, for several years. Uh-huh. And he urged her to leave Motown. Then then there's a long chapter. By the way, the book's 300 pages. There's hundreds of these of stories about her. But one of the more interesting ones was that Herman and a guy named Robert West took Mary to New York. And they were negotiating with other record companies, trying to get Mary the biggest possible advance you could get from one record company, from any record company. And eventually she did get a $250,000 advance from Atlantic Records, which was very nice. In any case, from 20th Century Fox Records, which was a very large amount, certainly at the time and even now. But in the meantime, West and Herman Griffin had a gunfight over which company Mary should go to, and in the course of the fight, Herman Griffin shot Robert West through the head with a pistol, which was a very frightening incident, which is described in the book. And West didn't die, but he came near to dying. But that was it for Mary and Herman. Even she, with her somewhat clouded judgment in that area, could see that she shouldn't keep a felon. He was never convicted, but they shouldn't keep a guy like that on the payroll. So they finally broke up. And then she went on to have more professional managers who did do a better job for her.
And so then, you've already talked about this a little bit, but Smokey Robinson, how does she come to meet him? And specifically, what are some of the songs he wrote for her?
Well,
with her, I should say.
She couldn't help but meet him. He was one of the songwriters at Motown. It was a very small company at the time. He wrote his kind of music. He was heavily influenced by Harry Belafonte, who I think is still alive now, and sang and wrote Caribbean style songs with bongos and a kind of rhythmic beat. In fact, I think Belafonte was from the Caribbean. Smokey Robinson wasn't, but he adopted Belafonte's musical style. And Robinson, unlike Belafonte, as far as I know, Robinson really knew how to write for female singers. He was a very sensitive guy. He had a great falsetto himself, and he was able to write these rocking songs that also attracted women because the lyrics and the intonation that Mary used appealed to female listeners. So they got along very well as singer and songwriter. They worked together very well, and they came up with, it was Two Lovers, for instance, which was shocking at the time because it seemed to imply that Mary had two different men as physical lovers. but actually, at the end of the song, it revealed the fact that she was talking about two different personalities of the same guy, her boyfriend. Then there was You Beat Me to the Punch, which fit in with the fighting, craze for boxing at the time. You don't hear that much really about boxing anymore, except among fans, but, there was Muhammad Ali and lots of other fighters who were big-name fighters and were very big celebrities at the time. So You Beat Me to the Punch was perfect, although it involved a girl and boy meeting, then getting together, then breaking up. And finally, My Guy, which was a fluttering hymn to fidelity, which really encapsulated Mary's feelings. She really wanted to find one guy she could be faithful to. So she put a lot of herself into the song, and all three were big hits, really the biggest hits of her career.
And it's after My Guy, of course, that she really starts taking off. And you write about her, she gets an opening slot with the Beatles, right? The Beatles were quite fascinated with her.
Yeah, well, they were very fascinated with her. At the time, there were very few black people in England, and there were very few records of black singers in England because they weren't imported commercially. The Beatles only knew about them because they lived in Liverpool, which was a big English port, and the sailors who would go back and forth on English ships would buy black American records in New York or wherever they landed, and then bring them back and play them for their friends. So the Beatles heard them. John Lennon's reaction was, why can't I sing like that? And he tried to change his singing so that he could sound more like a black person. In fact, the high falsetto that the Beatles used in many of their songs is supposedly a direct imitation of what a lot of black American singers were doing at the time. So when they came over to do a tour of the U.S., they saw Mary in concert and immediately adopted her as their sweetheart. And then, in fact, invited her back to England to be one of their opening acts on their own tour of England, where she was a massive hit because very few English people had ever seen any black people, much less an attractive female black singer. So there was this one guy I talked to, David Bell, who was 17 at the time. He got in trouble with his girlfriend because he went to see the Beatles and saw Mary. The girlfriend was obviously interested in him because she insisted on sitting in his lap throughout the concert. But he only had eyes for Mary, as they'd say. He couldn't get over how beautiful she was. He's now in his 60s and still collects Mary memorabilia, so it must have been must have had quite an effect on him. But that was a lot of English people were very, very affected by her. And there's a theory that English music since that time has been very affected by black music. There's still a group in England called Northern Soul. The Northern they're referring to is the north of England, not the United States, where all the people, they love, all the people in this movement love sort of relatively unknown Motown records. There was even a record company in England formed called Nightmare Records, but Nightmare doesn't refer to, the dream you have at night. It refers to a song by the Andantes, who later became a backup group. It's a very obscure song, but there are all these people that will travel all over England trying to find these obscure records. This group is going on today, so that shows you something about the impact that Mary and the others had on England. She was the first Motown star to ever appear in England, and she appeared with the Beatles, which certainly added to her credibility there.
So everything we've talked about so far, I mean, how old is Mary at this point when she opens for the Beatles? I mean, she's still very young.
21.
Yeah, so she's had all the success in a very early point. Tell us a little more then about her decision to leave Motown.
Well, she realized after a while by talking to other people in the business, and that's what you get to do when you go on tour, that she was being underpaid in a sense by Motown. I mean, the way everything was set up, she was getting about $75,000 a year, which from my point of view isn't that bad for today. This was in the early 60s. But she realized that the other people who had hits on the chart and worked for other record companies were getting something like $250,000 a year. So that was what she saw as her goal. She was as interested in money as Gordy was, didn't feel like that she should be losing the difference between $75,000 and $250,000 every single year that she was working. Now, Motown did this because, excuse me, not only did Gordy like money, but he needed the money at that time to bring along other singers. I mean, the Supremes did 10 records before they came out with any kind of decent hit. Most other record companies would not have supported them while they did 10 records. After two or three, they would have told them to take a hike. But that wasn't Gordy's business model. He saw something in them and believed that they could be developed into a group that would make money for him, so he kept pouring money into them. In a sense, though, a lot of the money was money if he ran another company, would have given to Mary. She realized this in time and decided to leave. The only real problem she had, though, was that she didn't bring Smokey Robinson with her. He had been made a vice president of the company, which presumably meant that he got some interest in the company, and he wasn't planning to leave. He's still there, as far as I know. I mean, the company has been sold, but all his creative career, he stayed at Motown. So that was a big mistake, and I could see, since she made this big decision at 21, how she could have made a mistake like that. I certainly made bad decisions at 21. I'm sure most people have, but usually they're not as life or career threatening as Mary's bad decision indeed was.
And even some bad decisions within leaving, like she handed over all the rights to her music, didn't she?
Yes, for a mere $30,000, which seemed to her like a large amount of money, and I certainly, even now, would make my day if I got a check for $30,000. But nevertheless, she gave away all her rights to Motown music, all the music she had recorded at Motown, recorded at Motown so far, which was all her big hits, basically, all but maybe one or two of her big hits. And that made sense at the time because, you know, most records went up the charts, then hit their high peak on the charts, and then were forgotten. You know, you can't find them anymore, except maybe, I mean, now you can, I guess, on YouTube. But in those days, you could find them in used record stores. But they weren't played anymore, so they were pretty much worthless. Motown broke the mold on that one. I mean, I just went into a restaurant the other night and heard Tammy Terrell doing Ain't No Mountain High Enough. I mean, this is 2013, and I'm still hearing records that were made in the early 60s. No one would have thought that would have happened, and Mary was among the 100% of the people who didn't believe that would happen. So it was a mistake, but it was a mistake that everyone else made as well. It just hurt Mary more because she took $30,000 to give up her rights to an income stream that, if she were alive, would be putting $80,000 or $90,000 a year in her pocket. So you never can tell.
Sure. And now I, like so many people that haven't delved into to her life that much, you know, we are most interested, of course, in these Motown years. These are the years that are most influential, I suppose, in rock history. But Mary has a recording career for the next, 23, 24 years after she leaves Motown. So even though I realize in this interview we're not giving enough justice to it, can you tell us about her career after Motown?
Yes, well,
in the next, 10 or 15 minutes.
Sure. Well, she did very well, actually. If you just looked at her career after Motown, it would have been a moderately successful career. She had hits at several companies. By hits, I mean top 100 hits. And she even had a few top 20 hits and even one top number one hit in those 22 years or whatever it was between the time she left Motown and the time she died. She had a fairly respectable career. The only thing it pales against, or is is her Mozart career, which was so astronomically spectacular and so successful that it makes the other, it casts a shadow on the other career. But the other career wasn't bad at all. Immediately after she left Motown, she had the hit Dear Lover, which was, it got up into the 40s or 30s on the chart, just like Bye Bye Baby had at the beginning of her Motown career. Then over the years, she had various songs. One was called The Doctor, you know, which compares two lovers to a doctor and a patient. And in just a couple of years before her death, she had a big hit called Gigolo. It was a big disco hit just at the height, or maybe near the end of the disco music craze, which is number one on several charts. The only problem was when she was recording music for other record companies, that is, record companies other than Motown, those companies weren't able to maintain those records at the top of the charts. You know, her, if you look at her actual chart at Motown, it would show, you know, a swift rise and then to the very top. But if you look at the charts at each of her her other companies, you know, like those charts you see in cartoons where the chief executive is trying to show the other executives how well they're doing, if you look at that line in the charts for the other record companies she worked for, it would show a rise and then a fall off. Then she'd come back from the bottom of the chart, but it wouldn't come quite as far. It would be like a series of hills going down. The problem was, I think, promotion. Now, promotion is a special term in the record business. It doesn't mean like when you get promoted, you know, from janitor number two to janitor number one. I mean, it's like, and it's not like advertising either. Promotion is when they have, each record company had a special promotions department where the promo men would go around to the disc jockeys, socialize with them, try to get them to play records more often. And they'd make visits to the Motown promo guys would make visits to the disc jockeys as soon as the each Motown record hit its peak and started to drop off. That's when they'd go back and do all sorts of things, allegedly, you know, pay them, which was illegal. I don't know if they ever did that. Maybe provide them with a social life, maybe drugs, I don't know, or just in the most innocent way, just talk to them about the record and tell them how good it was. In any case, they somehow got the DJ to keep playing it on the way down, which meant it stayed up much further. But that meant they had to constantly social, the promo men had to constantly socialize with the DJs, who at the time were mostly black. That is, the DJs who were playing Motown records, and the promo men at Motown were mostly black. So they had they found it easier to do it. Racism was still much more in effect then than it is now. So when Mary went to white-owned companies, white-owned promo departments, and white men and women promo departments, the white guys couldn't figure out how to keep the records in a high state of interest for the black DJs, and that I think was the real problem.
Mm-hmm. Through her career in Motown, she was what we call a crossover artist, white audiences, African American audience. Was she able to maintain that crossover appeal throughout her career?
No. Eventually, because she wasn't as popular as she was before, and they didn't, she never got a writer like Smokey Robinson again, who was the ultimate crossover writer. She was reduced to having most of her hits on the R&B chart, which is basically the black chart. So she was a fairly popular singer for black audiences and for black record stations. That's the kind of situation that Motown had been created to obliterate, that is, to keep everyone crossed over so that it appealed to the much larger white audience, as well as continue to appeal to the smaller but still substantial black audience, which grew over the years, by the way. So no, she became an R&B singer rather than a pop singer, which made her income lower and her popularity lower. But she, amazingly, she never got really discouraged. I mean, she may have been spiritually discouraged, but she kept going. If she couldn't make a hit, or she couldn't sing her song, or the audience wouldn't take her singing her songs on concert, on tour, she'd just sing her old Motown songs and eventually became queen of the oldies. You know, she was singing My Guy 28 years after it came out and still getting a lot of play for it. You know, songs like that are immortal, really. Last year's JCPenney Leap into Spring TV ad had as its entire soundtrack, and it was one of those long ads that showed couples, you know, blissfully barbecuing and, you know, sailing and stuff. The whole soundtrack was My Guy, which had been recorded originally in 64. So Mary was able to keep those songs popular or go along with their popularity for the entire rest of her career. It shows how good the songs were in the first place and how determined Mary was to continue her career, whatever happened.
Yeah, I think My Guy especially, I mean, that's among, you know, a small handful of songs really that are just, you know, they're the songs that have, you know, they it's hard to say a word, they're sublime in their popularity.
Yes.
That they last so long.
Right. I call them semi-immortal, which
sure.
I think is certainly commercially they're semi-immortal since they've lasted so long. I mean, you don't hear Purple People Eater or other songs of that era anymore, unless you run across the record somewhere. So they've lasted a long time, and it's because of her determination and the genius of the songwriters and producers at Motown.
And they are part of our culture now, a song like My Guy. I mean, everybody knows My Guy.
Yes, that's true. Even today, record business industry experts say it's played sometime on the air in the world at least once every 24 hours, which is really something for a song that old.
Yeah.
By the way, she had one of her hits, I've forgotten which hit it was. I shouldn't call it a hit because it wasn't a hit in the U.S., but when I was doing the chart research, I realized that it was a hit. It was a number one hit in the Philippines soon after she recorded it. Someone, you know, why do these things happen? Someone ought to figure out why it was a hit in the Philippines. It must have hit some cultural note that it didn't hit in the U.S. It's very mysterious the way music moves around the globe these days. And someone will figure out exactly why it does that. But as we all know, the industry has changed a lot since it was big record companies trying to get popular DJs to make songs into popular songs. That was the situation Mary was in for most of her career.
And there's so much we're going to have to skip over, such as she was married to Cecil Womack and then his brother Curtis Womack.
Yes.
As you said, she worked her entire life. She toured her entire life. Let's skip now for the end of our interview. Tell us about the last, I don't know, half decade or so of her life, the irony of the illness she gets, and maybe talk a little bit about Ian Levine and how he kind of rediscovered her and helped her career out.
Okay. Well, at age 16, Mary started smoking two packs of nicotine cigarettes a day and continued that for the rest of her life. People would talk about how when she would go to a meeting, and after the meeting was over and the doors would open, you know, huge clouds of smoke would float out, and she was the only one smoking. So it was easy to predict that she'd get throat cancer, which in fact she did. And that was very ironic, of course, because it was basically cancer of the voice box. She needed her vocal cords to sing. And in order to cure the cancer and not allow it to come back, the doctors would have had to remove her voice box. It was a laryngectomy. And she refused to allow them to do that because that would have killed her singing career. So they used chemotherapy and other techniques, which in the end didn't work, and she died at age 49. So her smoking killed her, and it hit her in, at least in career terms, the worst part of her body it could hit her in. So it was a bad way to go, but she fought right to the end. In fact, at the very end, when she was dying on her hospital bed and could hardly talk, she was telling the doctor about the song she would sing on her next singing tour, which was very optimistic. Ian Levine was one of those Northern Soul type producers. He was a London DJ who developed a fascination for Motown, and late 80s re-recorded as many Motown songs sung by their original singers as he could. And he also wrote a few new songs for Mary to sing. But they were all collected on various albums that were produced in England. Now, the songs are very good. Mary did a good job on them. She even did a duet with Frankie Gay, who was Marvin Gaye's brother, on one of Ian Levine's album. In the, you know, she had done a duet with Marvin Gaye in the 60s, but then Marvin was murdered by his father, speaking of bad ways to go, and she had to use Frankie for the Ian Levine re-recording of the duet.
Duet.
So, if the debate, it might have been, I don't think it would have been as good a record. But so yes, none of those, very few of those records were successful, but commercially. But Levine made a big contribution to musical history by re-recording all those great artists very late in their careers, including Mary. So all those albums are available on Amazon or other places, or perhaps at record stores if there are any of those left. But they can be obtained, and they show how well and how energetically Mary was performing it near the very end of her life.
And she did, at the very end of her life, she did try to sue Berry Gordy, didn't she? Or she did. How did that turn out?
Well, she. It depends on who you believe. There's some debate. There's a story from Curtis Womack that Berry offered her $1 million to stop going on TV after she got cancer, and saying how badly he treated her because he was getting so socially ostracized. But Curtis also said that she refused to accept $1 million and demanded that he give her $10 million, which is what she thought that Motown owed her. He wouldn't give her $10 million, and according to the story, and she wouldn't accept the $1 million. So apparently she ended up getting a much lower amount, something like $30,000, which he then used, but obviously didn't last very long because she didn't have, this is after she got cancer, so she didn't really have much of an income at the time. That would show, that fits in with her her profile in my mind, a profile of a determined person who wanted to get exactly all of what she was due, that she wasn't going to accept $1 million, which certainly would have made her life better financially, unless she could get everything that she thought she was due. And that's what she was like throughout her life. She'd drop men, including one brother, and move and then marry that guy's brother because she no longer liked the first brother. You know, she'd ruthlessly go ahead and even if it hurt herself, and do the best that she possibly could. And that's what made her both a determined and a very interesting and a very attractive figure in my mind.
And then tell the story quickly, or as long as you'd like, about this recovery right before she dies. Isn't there a moment where she has her voice for a day or two? Or
yes, that's true. That wasn't unique to her, though. That happens with a lot of people. A lot of people come out of a long sickness and suddenly they feel great and they can do everything they could do before. They figure, aha, I've broken the back of a beast. But what it turns out is that their system has just rallied for the last time and pushed out the disease, but it can't do it for more than 24 hours or so. So then they die right after that. And that's basically what happened to Mary. Her after years of being unable to speaking anything but a whisper, she could suddenly sing, and she felt great, and then basically she died shortly thereafter. Religious people say that that's God's way of indicating that when you go to heaven, all your powers will be restored. Non-religious people say it's just what I just said, that it's the body's last effort to throw off the oppressor. But so it's up to each listener to decide what they think happened with Mary. In any case, she died shortly thereafter, and but at least her songs live on, and also her story, which is in this book, and by the way, is the first and only book ever written about Mary Wells. So, I mean, I know I wrote it and I profit from it, but nevertheless, I think it's a very interesting story, and it will probably be the last book about a really great singer, a really great American black pop singer.
So I think it says a lot about somebody who shows up at their funeral. Who showed up at Mary's funeral?
Well, certainly Berry Gordy did, and all her extended family, and lots of her friends. It was a very crowded funeral, actually. It was more like a tribute to her. Smokey Robinson sang one of her songs. Stevie Wonder sang another one. And there were a lot of, it was like a celebration of her life. And almost everyone who knew her showed up. Incidentally, although she moved from her second husband, Cecil Womack, to her third husband, Curtis Womack, both Curtis and Cecil and their extended families who had reconciled showed up. So basically everyone in her life who could make it, possibly make it, was there, all reconciled with each other, which showed, I think, that she was basically a nice person, and they were going to overcome their differences in order to celebrate her life. So her life ended very well. It unfortunately ended too soon. 49 is not a particularly advanced age. And she, it's too bad that she didn't have many more years to perhaps make an even bigger comeback than she had already.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter, I thank you for writing this book. I love finding these books about, you know, we all assume somebody must have written one about Mary Wells, and nobody had, and you did. Fabulous. What are you working on now? Are you writing something new?
Well, I'm trying to get two books going. It's a question of which one I'll get a contract for first. One's about Rick James. See, it fits in because Flo was Mary Wells was an early Motown artist. Flo Ballard was a sort of mid-period Motown artist. And Rick James was the last big Motown artist. So it would be like bookending the whole subject. And also, he was a very interesting fellow, to say the least. There's also Farrah Fawcett, who no one has written a biography of Farrah Fawcett. I've done a lot of research on her with her earliest boyfriend, Greg Lott, who came back and was her lover at various portions of her life, much later in her life. And she was so popular and such a another determined figure. I mean, she got one of the few posthumous Emmy Awards or Emmy Award nominations that I've ever heard of for producing a movie about her own death, in which she actually died, of course, that I find her an astounding figure. So we'll see which one of those books comes out first, but I'll let you know as soon as I know which one's going to appear first.
Fabulous. Well, Peter, thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great. Although I sounded hoarse, it's just merely an imitation of Mary Wells and her first song, so don't take it personally. But it's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Peter.
You've been listening to a conversation with Peter Benjaminson about his book, Mary Wells, The Tumultuous Life of Motown's First Superstar, published by Chicago Review Press in 2012. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.